I wanted to remind everyone that welcome to the Pilates Progressions Program. I'm Katrina Foe, your host for tonight, and I think we had some technical difficulties there, but I think we're going now. I'm excited to get to answer all your questions about Pilates, teaching, taking, doing, and just living Pilates. So let's get started. I wanted to remind everyone that Reformer 2 is going on this weekend, February 27th to 28th in Scottsdale, Arizona. So good luck. That's probably one of my favorites. It's got so much meat in it. So if you want to audit it, make sure that you have let us know, and we got you all signed up and everything. Okay, we've got some great questions. I want to start with a fairly complicated one. This one comes from an instructor, and I'm going to read the whole question because it's kind of long and involved, and then I'm going to break it down into some different parts. All right, she wrote, hello, question. So I have this client named, I'm going to omit that. Sadly, she's leaving for Seattle soon, so I won't have too much time to work with her, but I was wondering what is going on with her. She does have bursitis in her hips, but I don't think that fully describes all of her pain. Maybe it does. She has had x-rays and MRIs of her hips and was told that there is no damage and she does not qualify for a hip replacement. They also said whatever there is should not cause her much discomfort. She has an extreme amount of pain going down the whole front of her right leg from the hip flexor area, quote, radiating all the way down to her ankle. It's a straight line. It happens when her leg is forward and when it is weight-bearing. Her physical therapist told her it is sciatica, but I have never heard of sciatica in the front of the leg, ? Maybe another nerve doing something similar to the sciatic? She also favors her right leg a lot. Even though it is the leg that causes her a huge amount of pain to stand on and walk on, she only stands on that leg, and when she walks, she mainly uses that leg. She does rotate slightly out when she doesn't pay attention. Footwork. First position, she feels a pain in her deep rotator muscle area of her hip, a sharp pain. She also feels a huge stretch in the front of the leg. When I put her in first with heels on, she feels nothing. Same as second heels on in a rotation. Balls of the feet parallel causes no pain. Her left leg is half the size of her right one. It is also significantly tighter. I've tried to have her focus on standing on it more as well as strengthening it more. Parentheses, standing leg pumps on that side, single leg work on that reformer, etc. Her right hip tends to hike a little, and she also tends to come down more heavily on the right side when bridging. When I put her on the BOSU with both legs on, she did not feel the pain she usually does when standing. We also did single leg balancing, and she did not feel pain when standing on her right side. She felt the work mainly in her upper quad area. It was harder for her to balance on her right leg compared with the left, which I found surprising since she uses it so much more than her left, regardless of pain. I stood her at the end of the reformer, holding on to the foot bar for balance, and when she extends her right leg in front of her, she felt work when she reached it behind her, the back of her leg hurt, and she felt a quad stretch. When we do side-lying legs, the back of her leg and the side of her leg hurt her. She describes it as a pulling and a bee sting. When doing the purple leg springs, they move pretty evenly. When we do the combo chair with pedals separate, she does leg pumps equally. Doesn't feel more in one leg versus the other. Also, no pain. She's a bit lordotic, tight low back, and a rib popper. She also has some sort of bone-on-bone type feeling popping in her spine when she shifts her ribs forward, rib popping, and then comes back to neutral. Whenever you get a chance, I would love some thoughts. Thanks. Okay, so very specific case study here, and highly unusual. As you know, a lot of clients present with very bizarre combination of things. And so first off, I just want to say probably this isn't just one thing. Okay, so for all you out there that are going, oh, my goodness, this is just a big nightmare, a disaster, you know, probably there's multiple things going on. And, of course, as I just want to put a disclaimer out there, I haven't seen this person moving, and I might have completely different things to say if I did see the person. I'm going to go off of what this instructor has mentioned and give my thoughts, and I'm going to elaborate because probably you guys have clients that might have some of these issues in a more general sense, and I want you all to benefit from it as well. So first off, I want to talk about bursitis and what is bursitis, because that was the first thing mentioned. She's got bursitis in her hips. So bursitis is an inflammation of the bursa. Anytime you see the word or the ending itis, it's going to be inflammation. So inflammation of the bursa. And the bursa are little cushions, basically, between the bones, tendons, joints, and muscles. They're little fluid-filled sacs that will help, they help cushion and pressure the area and lubricate the joints in between bones and tendons and muscles. Usually they occur near our joints. So the bursa are lined with what's called synovial cells that produce a lubricant that actually reduces friction. So they are literally helping with the lubrication whole process, and as well as the cushioning. So they allow our joints to move easily, and you don't feel a whole bunch of mechanical pressure and such when our joints move. However, when there's an inflammation of the bursa, you don't have the same synovial fluid being produced, and with the inflammation, it's not cushioning the pressure, it's causing pain. So extremely painful, usually when you move that joint. So in this case, we're talking about hip bursitis, and so when you're moving the hip joint is probably when the pain is going to be coming. Now, there's about like 160 bursa in the human body, so they're all over, and there's multiple bursa at each joint, particularly the hip. The hip's got quite a few bursas, and so I emailed this instructor back and just said, did she mention what kind of bursitis she has? And I gave some different types to that I thought might be an issue, and she emailed, and I also asked, was there any kind of an injury or surgery? And she wrote back that she doesn't know what type of bursitis and that she's not had surgery in that region. Okay, so just a little anatomy background for you guys. The hip bursitis, there's, again, lots of different types of the different bursitises. And I'm just going to go through a couple of them just so you can, you know, get some different ideas of what's going on. So you have the greater trochanteric bursa, the deep trochanteric bursa, the iliopsoas bursa, the gluteal medius bursa, ischiogluteal bursa, and the ischial tuberosity bursa. So there's lots of them, and that's just for the hip. Where you get the bursitis most commonly is in the trochanteric bursa or the iliopsoas bursa and possibly the ischial bursa. So I'm going to go over those three. The greater trochanter bursa is on the outside of the greater trochanter, as the name suggests, go figure. So the nice thing about all these bursas is they're named after where they are, which makes it a lot easier to know. So the greater trochanter is the outside knob of the head. It's not the head of the femur, but it's the outside knob to the side. So if you like put your hands where you think your hips are, on the outside of them, on the outside of your upper thigh, that knob you feel, that's your greater trochanter. So there's a bursa there on the outside between the muscles. And that particular bursa can get irritated if the iliotibial band, the IT band we call it a lot, is tight. So you'll feel hip pain down the side of your hip on the outside, that lateral side. And that's not what she was describing, so I'm guessing probably not that bursa. Now, the next one, the iliopsoas bursa, is right, it sits right between the iliopsoas where it passes in front of the hip joint. So that one is where she's talking about. So that one might be a really good, maybe that's it. And that bursa is going to get annoyed, if things in the front area, if particularly your psoas is overused or, you know, not functioning correctly. And then, like I mentioned, I was going to discuss the ischial bursa. The ischial tuberosity bursa, ischial bursa, it's down by where ischial tuberosity is, which are your sitting bones. It's a fancy name for your sits bones. And that ischial term is because it's on that ischial bone. So that's the name of the bone there. And that's kind of the bump of the bone that you sit on, the sits bones. Okay, so there's a little anatomy for you. And when you're dealing with these, again, most clients come in and they just say they have bursitis. So I'm not trying to fault this instructor for not knowing this. A lot of instructors don't even know there's multiple bursas at different sites, different joints and such. So, you know, knowing which birth site is not really that important. The only reason I asked her this, I thought the person might have mentioned it, but again, the doctors might not even mention it. So if they did, she might not remember that the doctor said this. It might just give a hint as to what's going on and you know, because this is so complicated and confusing sounded. So for the ileopsoas bursa, this bursa usually becomes inflamed and having all that inflammation because of overuse of the psoas, like I mentioned. The ileopsoas, meaning the iliacus muscle and the psoas major muscle. Those are the two we're talking about when we slang and talk about ileopsoas. Those two separate muscles. So overuse can tighten that muscle, which causes more pressure on that bursa when the hip is flexed. So hip flexion would usually annoy it, usually. Again, everything can be a little skewed depending on where exactly things lie and how they're inflamed and everything. Sometimes this can be mistaken for tendinitis or arthritis in the hip because the location of the pain and other symptoms. So just a little side note there. Now, this whole thing gets a little more complicated because of what she said next in terms of the sciatica. Okay, so the physical therapist told her that they thought it was sciatica. Now, I'm just going to go back because this is a whole nerve thing. She's talking about the client saying that she has pain shooting down in a straight line, radiating down from her hip flexor area, and it's a straight line. And she says it's when her hip is forward, her leg is forward, and when she's weight-bearing and stuff like that. Sciatica is an inflammation, annoyance of the sciatic nerve. And if you go back into your anatomy, I guess heavy on the anatomy, your sciatic nerve exits the spinal cord, the canal, at like, you know, L4, L5, S1, S2, that kind of thing. And it exits posteriorly, and then it travels under the pelvis, kind of behind the pelvis, down the back of the leg, and it innervates the whole back of the leg. So when somebody has sciatica, they're going to feel low back pain possibly, and they're going to feel pain in that SI joint where it comes through in that greater sciatic notch and then down the back of the leg. And the further down the leg it goes, the more intensely that is being pinched. That nerve is being annoyed and irritated. It's a big nerve, okay? And it's really common because of the area that's crossing through for it to get pinched for a variety of reasons. And what's causing the pinching can really help determine what to work on in terms of helping release the pinching. So sometimes the piriformis can pinch in there, and they call that specifically piriformis syndrome. Sometimes the facets can get caught up there in the vertebrae and be pinching it, you know, so it can happen and occur at different places. Now, again, you're right. I've never heard of sciatica traveling down the front. So I'm not quite sure what that physical therapist was thinking. Maybe they got different information from her. Different things might have been bothering her at the time, and they were talking about something different. I might give them the benefit of the doubt there because I don't know where she's going with sciatica there. In terms of pain in the front of the hip, my guess would be probably the femoral nerve. The femoral nerve comes out of like L2, L3, L4 area, so a little higher up in the spine, and it's going to cross underneath the inguinal ligament, which is the ligament that goes from the ASIS to the pubic bone. It's like a big straight line, that groin area, if you will, that men tend to have the pull. It goes under there along with some of those other muscles that we talked about. And with it kind of sits and passes down through the front of the leg in between, sitting in between sartorius, iliacus, and psoas major, and then pectineus. So it kind of sits in between there. So I'm going to go out on a limb and say that makes a lot more sense considering that she's having trouble with some hip flexion issues and feeling the pain in the front of the leg. Now, of course, neither I nor you are a doctor, nor should we be necessarily diagnosing this. So I'm just telling you this for your own personal understanding of what's going on with her. Don't go to her and say, oh, we think you have femoral nerve damage or you know something bizarre like that because we don't know. So something might be pinching that femoral nerve. Now, the interesting thing is if you look at like a cross-section of the hips, that femoral nerve, where it sits, is real close to that that iliopsoas bursa. Okay, and so it's kind of interesting as to how. By the way, I've also seen this called the iliopectineal bursa. It's real. There's different names a lot of times for different anatomy parts, which makes the whole thing more confusing. So just if you see that, don't get confused. So I'm thinking that there's a real connection there possibly between that bursitis and this nerve issue thing. I don't know what that is. Maybe it's one, maybe it's the other. Maybe there's some confusion over what exactly is causing pain and what's happening there. I don't know. I'm going to go with the bursitis is possibly, you know, the whole main thing going on, but it could be either one. And again, it could be multiple things, like I mentioned at the beginning. So I'm going to talk about a couple of the different symptoms you mentioned and give you some thoughts on that. And then I'm going to go through and give you what I would do if I was working with her. And again, take a big, big chunk of, you know, grainy salt there with this, because I haven't seen her and I'm not working with her. So you need to make some calls and adjustments based on what you actually see, because you get to be with her. All right, so footwork. You talked about when she's in first position with the balls of her feet on the bar, it hurt her hip and she got a sharp pang. But when she did parallel or heels on the bar, it didn't. Okay, here's something that we want to think of. When you have your heels dangling down under and having to work to hold them together, as in the turned out position of first position, you have to use your adductors. So that pectineus muscle and particularly psoas major are going to be working there. And if you have your heels on the bar, they're being held still, so you don't have to have the adductors working, as well as if you have, you know, first position heels parallel, the balls of the feet parallel position. So not first position, but the parallel position. It's kind of interesting, though. So I want to say that kind of goes along with what we're talking about, is because of the adductor work that would annoy that, possibly. I think it's really interesting her left leg is so much smaller than her right one. It does make sense if she is using her right leg so much more that it is bigger. I'm going to say guess that's because it's stronger, but that's not necessarily the case. With this whole weight-bearing thing and how she tends to weight-bear on the side that's hurting, there's a reason for that. And if you can figure that out, you're doing really, really well. That's going to be a tricky thing. So probably there's a reason, meaning that she's got some kind of compensation pattern that makes it less painful than if she stands on the left. Because if it's less painful for her to stand on the left, she would do that. So there's a reason there, and you want to try to figure that out. I don't know what that would be, but anyways. Her right hip tends to hike a little, and she also tends to come down more heavily on the right side when bridging. Again, all these are going to show that there's some kind of an imbalance there going on. So the hip hiking, she's going to tend to have a compensation pattern there. I'm going to say either she tends to be really tight in her obliques, or more likely she's really weak in her abductors, the outside of her hip, okay? Or maybe that's where her, you know, her trochanter bursitis is, you know, and that's painful for her to use the outside of her hip to get her hips level. I don't know. Again, we're just throwing some thoughts out there. Putting her on the BOSU and having it not hurt, I think, is really interesting indicator. The BOSU really changes where your center of gravity is and might force it to go into a good place. So that might not be that crazy. And then in terms of some of the other stuff you said, side-lying legs and such, again, side-lying leg position, I think if she did have that trochanteric bursitis, that would really annoy it, because, again, the IT band is going to be really pulled taut and having to be, have a lot of pressure on it. So maybe she's got bursitis several places. Who knows? And that very, very well could be, because a lot of times when you get one thing irritated, you go into a compensatory pattern, and then something else is going to get irritated because it's taking more of the work than it should have. Okay, if she's a little bit lordotic, and, you know, rib popper would be just a sign of lordosis and such, and also the tight low back. Again, that just might be giving you an indicator that something else might be going on there. So she could be, you know, compensating for whatever. And there's a really strong connection between the hips and the low back. Go figure, they're really close to each other, right? So you want to be looking at that. So if I were you, I would be focusing on trying to make her work symmetrically if possible. Because, again, there's a big asymmetry going on here. And getting her to bring her attention in everyday life, as well as, of course, and applies to you, to standing on both feet evenly and finding how she can ground herself and stand on her foot evenly. I would guess that she's probably not standing on her foot in the center, so that the ball of her foot, the inside and outside, and then the heel, that tripod, is not even. So try to get her to feel that weight. So the easiest way to do this is to have her stand on her feet and have her shift forward to her balls of her feet and back to her heels and back and forth. And then once you've found both end ranges, center feels, you know, center. And so maybe, you know, just a quick exercise in that. And if it's really wacky for her, that's a good exercise in and of itself for her to do as often as she can think about it during the day. You can also do that side-to-side shifting to find center on your feet. But you might have already noticed, and it wasn't mentioned, if she stands funny. But again, getting her lined up to where her head is over her shoulders, is over her pelvis, is over her feet, is going to be really, really critical so that she feels both feet evenly. So any exercise that you cue her on, cueing her to feel both sides evenly. So maybe if she's doing, like you mentioned, a bridging exercise of sorts or something, feeling both sides of her spine go down evenly, feel the butt cheeks evenly weighted. If she's even just sitting, doing something like arm series or, you know, rowing series or something, front or back or, you know, whatever, talk to her about feeling both hips evenly weighted, both butt cheeks evenly weighted. So you're not just doing the exercise, but the bigger principle for her is to find that symmetry in her body. So I don't think it's bad to do single leg things to focus more on standing on it, but I think it's, in terms of the application to daily life, having her do things where she gets her weight evenly centered is going to be really huge. You might want to play with the standing leg series with the spring. So you've got the spring around your ankle and you're standing and you do the front side, back side, you know, all the way around. Because the standing leg, and again, this isn't about the spring leg. This is the standing leg. The standing leg is going to want to slump so that this hip hikes. And getting her into neutral pelvis there on the standing leg, not the one with the spring, is going to be profound possibly. It might really irritate her if she's got the bursitis in there, but it could be really profound to working those abductors to get that nice and stable and help her find what neutral pelvis is and not hip hike. Let's see. So some exercises like that to help her bring to her attention and her awareness where she is in space and what she's compensating. And, you know, because a lot of times people don't even notice that they're, like, sinking into one hip and always putting their weight on one leg. Okay, and I think you're saying that real clearly, that you're seeing that she's not symmetrical, but she might not. And so I think you are already seeing this, but I just want to bring this to everyone else's attention in case everyone else doesn't see that. This can be life-altering, just that little awareness. And whether it's somebody with a bursitis or somebody with a scoliosis or something where it's asymmetrical, you really start to develop these really deeply ingrained patterns of, so, you know, new moms do this a lot too. There's no injury, but they got a baby, and they always put the baby usually on the left side, so then their right hand, which is their dominant side often, is free to do little tasks. Okay, well, then you start sinking into the hip, and you start to develop all these wacky, funky things because you're being asymmetrical. So just bringing their awareness to that as often as they can during the day is absolutely huge. And trying to practice being symmetrical on any exercise. And you can do that on any exercise. Almost all of them that are not asymmetrical exercises would work. Asymmetrical exercises would be good to just bring her awareness, but really watch her and especially work on that the things you're seeing. So the lordosis, if you take the pressure out of her back and get her abs to start holding her pelvis neutral, that's going to change the relationship of her pelvis to the head of that femur. And that might make a big difference in that bursitis. Okay, so there might be a reason that she's in that big anterior tilt, that arched low back, because maybe her psoas is really tight and overused. So that's, you know, putting her into hip flexion all the time, and maybe it's easier. Maybe that's going to help her open that up to start stretching that and find neutral. So, you know, doing some things like a pelvic clock to help her find neutral pelvis and things. I don't know that I would, but you could try, and you probably have a sense of whether this would be a good idea. You might have already done this with her. You know, something like Eve's lunge to try to open up the front of her hip, it might just drive her crazy. It'd be way too much. So use, you know, go with discretion there. But even just some things like a swan, where you're pressing the pubic bone into the box and lifting the belly off to try to get more of a neutral pelvis, is going to be really profound, possibly, for her to opening up and changing what's in the hips. Even though, you know, what you're working on is really core and pelvic placement, it really changes the relationship to the hips. Okay, so look for those basic imbalances, whether it's the feet or the low back, and things that you've already noticed, and work on that, because generally if you start to help the muscle balancing in all the other areas that are contributing factors, it can really help take the pressure off those hips. And with the bursitis, they need that pressure taken off. Okay, so to finish up talking about the bursitis stuff, again, usually if you look bursitis up, they talk about, you know, what causes bursitis, and they talk about it being caused by an injury or some kind of an overuse or something like that. Well, what causes that? It always drives me nuts. Okay, well, why is that happening? And there's a lot of talk nowadays about inflammation in the body in general, whether it's bursitis or, you know, arthritis or any of these other things, itises, that there's a very, very, very strong link between that and food. Okay, so, you know, you kind of get a little outside your scope of practice, but sometimes it's good to mention this because it is so not something the doctors talk about, and it's usually not something that people will hear about, and it can be really, really helpful. So just simply mentioning that, you know, I've heard that there's a lot of between inflammation in the body and possible food sensitivities or allergies. So this could be something that the top food allergies are, you know, gluten, dairy, soy, corn, what else am I missing? Oh, there's so many of them. Eggs is one. So if you can help them think of, you know, possibly delving into looking at what they eat, and, you know, it could be just as simple as they make a food diary and write down everything they eat. You know, not from a calorie standpoint, but I had some eggs and, you know, with butter on them or in something, just so you know that there's dairy and there's eggs. And then I had a piece of toast, you know, and you know, whatever. You can tell the types of food there were. And then another relationship of how their bursitis is feeling. And just take a log of that. They might be able to figure out what it is just by that. And sometimes, you know, a quick elimination diet can confirm that, where they just eliminate that food. I know gluten takes like 3 weeks to get out of your system, so that could not be a quick thing. But again, 3 weeks is not very long to figure out compared to trying to get into a doctor or something sometimes. So, you know, there might be some really profound connections. I've really seen a lot in terms of working with clients with arthritis and the connection to their food, and really being able to get away from the pain by eliminating certain foods and figuring out what's irritating them. So just keep that in mind, because when you're working with a lot of these chronic conditions, these chronic inflammations, it may not be the movement. It may be the food. And there's so much, I don't know if contamination is the word, but there's so much cross mixing of food. Things are, when the processed food that people eat, even if you're eating something like, you know, ketchup, you know, there's corn in everything. There's, you know, flour in everything. So if you're trying to be gluten-free, or if you've got an allergy to corn or something, it's very, very hard to really be pure and keep that out completely. And if you're really sensitive and have some kind of inflammation coming from one of those little foods, it can be almost impossible to get it gone and really tell that it is because in the food labels, they name them all different sorts of things. They have like 10 names for, you know, probably a lot more than that for, you know, gluten products. It's very hard to tell what has it and what doesn't. So anyways, just some thoughts on that on a little side note, because it can really make a big difference when you're trying to work with somebody. So again, for bursitis, any itises, kind of backing away and from annoying that. So again, just the simple idea that if it hurts, don't do it. If you feel pain, whether that nerve, that femoral nerve is being pinched, or whether it's annoying the bursitis, it's your body telling you that that is not a good movement for right then. And so just go with it. This is not something to try to push through. It's saying that this is not a good movement pattern. And so you might want to adjust their alignment. If she's doing it really sloppy with a big arch in her back, you know, just correcting that and getting your abs to pull her pubic bone forward and up to get that neutral pelvis and such might be able to take the pressure off enough for her to do the exercise. But again, it's not about the exercise. It's about finding the correct movement patterns so that eventually this bursitis will settle down and go away. Because, I mean, it's all about not having pain at the end of the day. It's not about, you know, looking like Jennifer Aniston. It's about not being in pain, because you have to live with that body, you know, or your client does. Okay, so I'm going to take a little minute, and I want to talk about feet. I had somebody asking me some questions about feet and particularly plantar fasciitis, so I wanted to take a few minutes and discuss it a little bit more thoroughly for them as well as for you guys, because I know this is one that can really be confusing. And it's talked about a whole lot, and a lot of people say a lot of weird things. If you look up plantar fasciitis, they talk about the inflammation of the plantar fascia. Well, what is that? The plantar fascia is a band of connective tissue that goes from the metatarsals, so the balls of your feet, to your heel, which is your calcaneus bone, so your heel bone. And what it's doing is it's trying to, connective tissue-wise, hold the foot. The metatarsals connect to the calcaneus so that there's an arch. There's a lifting up. So think of those like Greek and Roman arches that they have, and how they have all those little small stones and how they arch over and they just stay there. This is holding that, and it's your ankle bone and your whole foot is like all those small little bones held in that arch. And so the plantar fascia goes along the plantar surface of the foot, the bottom of the foot, and holds that so that that arch stays lifted. Now, that's a lot of pressure on that fascia. And it should be supported and really not having to do an extra any work, because it's fascia, it's not muscle. There are muscles that run all along the bottom side of your foot. I mean, so many. When I've built the foot out of clay, it'll take like an entire day to do the lower leg and the foot, just an entire day to build all the little muscles. There's that many. There's little muscles that actually wrap around the toes to give a spiral motion to them. It's unbelievable. Same thing with your fingers, too. Anyways, so the arch muscles in your foot, there's tons of them running through there that point the foot and make it that nice, beautiful shape and everything. They should be strong enough to hold that arch up and kind of bolstering it. If they are not doing their job, then the weight of the body pushing down will start to flatten that arch. And if that arch starts to get flattened, then that plantar fascia starts to have a lot of pressure on it, and it'll start to get inflamed, thus the itis, and so that it gets to be very painful. And usually the pain will be right in front of the calcaneus, so just towards the toes of the heel bone, so right on the heel bone on the side towards the toes. And it can be very, very painful, and people will think maybe they even broke up their some bones in their foot or something. It can be very, very painful. But it is, most people, they'll talk about it and they'll just say, oh, it just kind of happens. Well, no, it doesn't just happen. there's some contributing factors. So again, the muscles have not been doing their job. This is particularly common when people gain a lot of weight, so there's a lot more pressure pushing down on the arch, which might overcome the strength of the muscles in there. So the muscles might have been good if you weighed 150, but if you gain 50 pounds, you know, in a couple months, all of a sudden it's not enough to hold the arch in your foot. So can you think of sometime that happens? I know, pregnancy. Isn't that a bummer? The other thing with pregnancy is that you got to remember that you have that relaxing going through your body, and so that's going to make all of the connective tissue a little less connective. It's going to make it a little weaker and more prone to stretching out and loosening up. Again, for good reason, because you want to have the connective tissue that's in your pelvis open up to let the baby out. But again, it's going to open up that plantar fascia, and so it can make the bones in your feet maybe looser, so that all the connective tissue is a little looser, so it's putting extra pressure on that, as well as the muscles not being as strong when you have that sudden weight gain. But anytime people gain a lot of weight, there's going to be a lot of extra pressure, and you're having extra stress on that. Also, if people are doing a lot of walking, if they're on their feet a lot, and you know, people will say, if you look online, that it's because you don't have supportive shoes. Well, you know what I think about that. The supportive shoes are just kind of an external way to bolster up what should be happening and being done in the inside of the foot by the muscles. So sometimes people are more likely to have this happen if they tend to roll in on their feet, like pronation. Again, that's a sign of a collapsed arch. If they have really high arches or flat feet, so both extremes can put excessive pressure on the plantar fasciitis and can, you know, kind of set someone up for that. If you do lots of running, standing, walking, I mentioned, especially for long periods of time, especially on hard surfaces. So like if you run, but you run out on the grass versus if you're running on the sidewalk, it's going to be a lot different on your feet. If you're overweight, particularly if you gain weight quickly in the last little bit, and, you know, tight Achilles and calf muscles is another thing that people blame it on a lot, but I would argue it's more the weakness in the sole of the foot. So in terms of what they feel, people with plantar fasciitis, they have sharp shooting pain when they take their first step. So if you get out of bed, or if they've been sitting a long time, they stand up on it, and then after they take a few steps or have been walking a little bit, it kind of subsides. So the blood gets circulating to it, it starts to relax. The muscles start to take over and do their job, but that should happen quicker. It shouldn't have that first few steps like that. It hurts the most for a lot of people when they climb stairs or if they're standing for a long time, that kind of thing. Let's see. I wanted to mention this because a lot of times we as instructors want to know what to do with this. Traditionally, people go to a physical therapist, they go to a doctor, they tell them it's plantar fasciitis, and they go to a physical therapist, and the physical therapist has them doing a series of stretches for their calf, different areas of their calf, and then sometimes the sole of their foot. So they're stretching those muscles. Now, the calf muscles run down and attach into the bottom of the foot, some of them all the way up to the metatarsals, but that's not the plantar fasciitis. A lot of them have them do ice. They tell them, you know, don't be on your feet as much, et cetera, et cetera. Get some good shoes, all this kind of stuff. I would argue that what will really help, and what I've seen with clients, it really helps, is actually to do work for the sole of that foot. Okay, now, this shouldn't hurt the plantar fasciitis. To actually work those muscles is not irritating the fascia. But again, it's not necessarily what you see a lot. So how do you work the foot? Well, we have these fabulous little tools in the Pilates studio, and Joe was just a genius when he created the foot corrector. Because I swear he had to have been doing it for people with plantar fasciitis because it's like made for that. Now, the foot corrector, the way it works is, you know, I'm just going to go through it in case you haven't worked with a foot corrector or maybe you haven't been doing it recently. You plant your heel down at one end and go online at Pilates.com on Balanced Body's website and see what one looks like because this may not make sense. It's a very weird little machine. And you plant your heel down at one end and you put the ball of your foot over the round black part that has the springs on it. Okay, so you are going to be pushing up and down on that round dome piece that your ball of your foot is on while your heel stays grounded. So the weight of your body is back towards your heel. You're not going to lean your body weight over it. That would push it down just from your body weight pushing it. But what you're trying to do is you're pointing your foot, so you're using the muscles in the sole of the foot, and you're maintaining that as you as you move the ankle joint. So you're not actually moving the sole of the foot. You're holding that in a pointed position, and you're moving at the ankle joint. So on the up phase, so you're bringing the whole springs up and the dome part up. That's the part that's the hardest to coordination-wise to keep the point in the sole of the foot while you're flexing the ankle. And so you actually have the springs are trying to open up and they're helping you with that. And then on the easier part and the parts where you really need to work to get the strength, it's actually you have to push down and so you have the springs resisting you. So it works magnificently exactly in the way that you need it. Now, I have played with this and it is very, very possible to get the work without a foot corrector. The problem is that most people don't have enough coordination to be able to do this. So people aren't very coordinated with their feet, in case you haven't noticed. And so to try to replicate this movement is very, very tricky. However, it is possible. And I say this because I have had clients in the past that need to work on this more than, you know, once a week that they're coming in the studio or even twice a week. They should be doing this every single day. And so to work on this, if they can get the coordination, it could be profoundly helpful. So what you can do is just have them sit. Any old position will do. They can sit in their easy chair if they want. I a lot of times will have people, you can just cross one leg over the other. So so your knee is kind of in that, like it looks like a number four. So you've got your shin on top of your other knee, if you will. Not the full cross legs, but partially. And your ankle is free. Okay, so there's no weight on that ankle, and that's the one you're going to work on. So what you want to do is point that foot, and you want to try to point the foot without crunching the toes. So you're not, like, clawing at something. You want to think of your toes actually lengthening out. So you're not trying to create some little hammer toes and ball them up. You're trying to point by flexing all the little joints between that calcaneus, the heel bone, and the metatarsals. We're not actually working on the tarsals, the toe joints themselves. We're working on the arch part. So don't try to ball the toes up. And that's the first thing that most people do wrong. They're doing everything in their toes, and that's not what you're looking for. So once you have that, and I say that with love because that in itself is really hard for people, and that might be as far as they get with this exercise. And as an instructor, what you might want to do is actually take a hold of their toes and lengthen their toes out if they're really crunching them up. You want to lengthen them and stretch them out and maybe even put your fingers against the very end of their toes and say, press into my toes to push the toes out so they're doing it from the inside. And so they're keeping that pointed foot, and then they're trying to hold that as they flex their ankle. And then they point the foot again and open the ankle. They keep the foot, the sole of the foot in that sickle shape as they flex and point the ankle. All right, now that's tricky. So you should try that yourself because the coordination is a little tricky for a lot of people. It is very doable, and you will feel the sole of your foot working very, very clearly and easily for most people. That could elicit a crampy thing. So if that happens, pull the toes back and flex the whole sole of the foot to open that up and just stretch those muscles just like you would any other joint muscles that might get a cramp in them. Cramp is just an indicator they're weak. You're working them, they're weak, and they're going, okay, we got enough. That's as much as we can handle. Stop now, please. Thank you. It's not a sign that you're low in potassium or, you know, you're dehydrated or anything that people, crazy things people say. Very, very unlikely. It's just a sign you're weak. People cramp, hamstrings, feet, you know, that kind of thing. It's very, very common. It's people's weak spots. And it goes away very, very quickly as they get stronger. Okay, so that's one little thing you could do. You can also just layer pointed feet into almost any Pilates exercise. Okay, that's huge. Just having them play with the pointing the feet, again, not crunching up the toes, but just pointing the feet, having them use the foot corrector, having them mimic the foot corrector at home, this is going to be huge. Now, some other things I wanted to mention, and this is something whether people have plantar fasciitis or not, this is just a fun little variation. Most people tend to do the foot corrector with the foot corrector, the leg straight in front of them. If you do it from a turned out leg position and the foot corrector is pointed to the side, so what you would do is you stand in like your Pilates first or, you know, a little turnout, and then you point one foot to the side and set the foot corrector up there so that they can have their heel on it and put the ball of their foot on it, and their legs, their toes and hips and knees are all externally rotated, and the foot corrector is along that line of that. It's awesome. I recommend doing it near Cadillac or, you know, the end of the reformer foot bar or something they can hold on to, because this is quite difficult. You want them to really connect into their core and hold that everything still in that pelvis, get hips nice and even, and then they're doing just the regular up and down motion. And the fabulous thing is, not only do you get the footwork, but you get this whole work up the back side of the leg into those deep, deep external hip rotators. And if you really hold that pelvis still without just clenching in your butt cheeks, you'll find that in a lovely, lovely way. And your adductors are working to hold you, you know, from falling over and everything. It's great. So try that. Again, all the same variations that you do with the regular foot corrector work, just from a turned out position. It's fabulous. Okay, so another thing, another series that you can do is the parakeet feet. Parakeet feet is intensely hard for a lot of people. A lot of people that have plantar fasciitis have very inflexible feet. That's one of the reasons that we instituted the purple balls. The purple balls aren't getting the work of the foot corrector, but they are really good at loosening up the foot as a whole, getting the muscles looser, which is a very big part of it. So the parakeet feet, what tends to happen is that people are so weak and so stiff that they can't get the sole of their foot to hold on to that bar. So don't even do the parakeet feet. Just do the push through with the foot bar up and down and just try to hold on to it. And you can spot the bar, so hold on to it a little bit. You're not keeping their feet on necessarily, but you're just, if they accidentally let go, you've got it so it doesn't go flying into the mirror, or, you know, lose the spring across the room or something crazy, scare somebody so bad on the next machine over they fall off or something crazy. And just help them hold on to the bar with the foot. Wrapping it around without crunching the toes is profoundly hard. And again, that push-through bar is really, really helpful. You can put your hand on top of their foot and encourage it to lengthen around the bar and that kind of thing. But really doing the work from the inside is a great place. So you can, you know, intermittently put more footwork in their lesson just multiple times by adding some of these exercises. Now, another exercise that, this is just kind of a Katrina variation, that I like to work on this is in the feet and straps. So with the feet and straps, you know, they've got the strap down in the arch of their foot, the long straps, and, you know, probably like a red and a blue or something spring-wise. If they're heavier, maybe two reds, something like that. And you're going to do the frogs. So heels together, knees and toes pointing out, you know, a small V, and they're going to bend and straighten it. Now, what you want to do, this is the variation, you're going to keep the heels touching the entire time. So you can play with putting a sticky there. If they have a hard time with that, this is not going to work, but you're keeping the heels together. And as you do this, instead of flexing your feet, you're going to point your feet. And you're trying, depending on how flexible they are with their feet, to get the toes touching and the heels touching, and those two things stay touching as they straighten and bend their legs. So it's pretty easy when the legs are bent, but as they straighten their legs, it gets harder and harder to keep the toes and the heels touching, and that's going to make the sole of the foot work to keep the point in there. So whether or not their toes stay touching, if they're trying to do that and just keep the heels together, they're going to get crazy work in the arch of the foot, and that's the whole point. So, again, another place you can play with it. Just be very forgiving if their toes don't touch. it's okay, they can still get the work, which that's the whole point. Now at home, at home they can do several things. They can mimic the foot corrector like we talked about. They could do these frogs. They could do them with their heels gliding along the floor, just sitting up and, you know, working on that. That would be awesome. They can do just pointing and flexing the feet. Okay, that's huge. You can also do a little towel work. And this actually gets the muscles more under the toes, or at least in addition to. And some people can be so toe dominant, they don't get the arch of the foot. So that's the possible thing that can go wrong with this exercise. If you have clients that are so used to using their toes and not the arch of their foot, it may backfire. So this might not be the ideal exercise. So you lay out a hand towel on the floor, and you want to do this on a tile or hardwood floor, not on carpet because it's just going to stick. You plant their heel down, so they're like maybe sitting in a chair or something. You could do it just having them sit on the floor, but it's going to work better with their up over it kind of more. Plant their heel down, and then they're going to use the sole of their foot to kind of swipe and scoop up the towel and kind of ball it up under the sole of the foot and drag the towel into them. Then once they get it all dragged in, you lay it back out nice and do it again. So it's very dynamic. As you watch them do that, watch if they use the outside of their foot more or the inside of their foot more, or if they're just using their toes to scrunch it up. We don't want the toe thing. We want it nice and even from inside and out, and get them to swipe the whole thing. So if they're doing more the outside of the foot, tell them to do more the inside and vice versa. So they can really work on that as well. So those are just some ideas on things to work on with the plantar fasciitis. This usually does take a while to get it calmed down. Just like I mentioned with the bursitis, I guess this is the itis night, this could have something to do with food in terms of the inflammation. I would say that plantar fasciitis usually has more to do with the just weakness in the feet. Okay, so it is so common for people to be super stiff and super weak in the feet, and the quick and easy answer is, well, stick some arch supports in it. And yes, that does help, and it does feel good, and especially if you have like some kind of a gel sole or something, that can feel really nice, but it doesn't fix the problem. Okay, I just want to repeat that. It doesn't fix the problem. So what happens? It just keeps getting worse, and then you need bigger arch supports and more gel and, you know, all this stuff, and it's just a very sad state where people's feet need to be addressed and taken care of. And if they don't take care of it, you know, because it seems like kind of a stupid thing, all right, I do this point flex thing, you know, whatever, exercises, I got better things to do with my life, they need to work on this because it'll get unbearable to where they can't even walk, and it's very, very debilitating. So, you know, this is a huge quality of life type issue, and we really need to take it seriously and help our clients take responsibility for their body and be motivated and give them the tools to help them so that they can feel better and have good healthy feet so they can get around and run after their grandkids and, you know, take that walk if they want to, and they don't have to feel like they're limited by their body breaking down and that they can't do anything about it. That's to me the saddest thing. So my big takeaway, as always, I like to end with this. Don't forget, we want to empower our clients that movement should feel good. Movement should not be painful. Movement should not hinder what we want to do in life. Our bodies are designed to be a vehicle to help us reach our goals and have the relationships we want to have, and they shouldn't be hindering us. So our beautiful gift of a job is to be able to help people and empower people to be able to move with ease and enjoy movement. So on that note, we're going to end tonight, and I just encourage you guys to email me your questions for next week so we can get those questions answered, and you will be a better instructor for it. So have a great night, and I'll talk to you later.